Hi.
Hi.
Thank you, Leo Hansen. Leo Hansen, Leo, give us a few words about your shakuhachi piece this morning.
Well, the music I play is called Honkyoku, which means original music. And it was played by Zen priests of the Fuke sect of Zen Buddhism in Japan between 800 and, well, the music is about 1300 to 1400 years old. And the priest, Komoso, would wander around Japan playing this instrument, begging for alms for their temples and for food. And it is thought that the instrument itself was the only instrument ever made specifically for religious purposes. And the instrument in their hands was not a musical instrument, it was for religious purposes.
Uh-huh. Enough. Well, thank you. Thank you. Okay. So, this morning I'm going to talk about a Zen poem that comes from just prior to the beginning of the Shakuhachi, although it's in China, not in Japan. And I'm going to start talking about it today, and then I'm going to talk about it when I give Sunday talks for a while till I get through it. And some of you are quite familiar with it because it's chanted a lot around Zen centers and in the world. It's the Sandokai, harmony of separation and oneness. And we've been known to chant it here too. Matter of fact, I think we still do sometimes in retreats. I don't know if we do it on Saturday morning anymore. No. So I'm going to talk about the title and the first line today, and then we'll see how many more talks come out of this, because it's got quite a few lines. I'm not going to be talking from this book. This book is Branching Streams Flow in the Darkness by my teacher Suzuki Roshi. I'm not going to be talking from it, but I may dip into it a few here and there, because it's fun to dip into. And the book's probably still around, because most of his books are still around. Okay. I'm going to try to do it without being too technical. Harmony of separation and oneness. Harmony of the many and the one. This is the 8th century in China. And this is a poem by Sekito. Sekito is two generations after Wei Nung, who is very important in history of Zen. And it's before Rinzai and Soto had split into two. Well, I guess I'm getting a little technical here. Well, I'm not supposed to do that on Sundays, but sorry. it's really got a Huayan basis, for those of you who know Huayan. Strong Huayan basis. Let's start with harmony. Harmony. It's three words, right? Harmony, separation, oneness. Harmony. So harmony is important in Chinese culture in the 8th century. It's important in any kind of, in any urban culture, actually in any rural culture. Harmony is important. Harmony is how people get along. And basic Confucian value. China is a Confucian country. Basic Confucian value. Harmony with your students, with your teacher, with your parents, with your siblings, with the emperor. Hierarchical harmony and lateral harmony. And there's always the possibility that things will get out of harmony, or that you'll realize that you are not in harmony with someone, or someone's not in harmony with you. Hi. Come on in. Oh, don't sit on the floor there. There's chairs. So that Confucian way, the way of harmony, is human heartedness, mencius, human heartedness. But that's pre-Zen. That's pre-Zen because it's harmony in which you you shake hands, and the meaning of harmony in Chinese etymologically is to shake hands. So you shake hands with someone. You're in harmony with them. You shake hands with them. So it's the shaking hands. But lots of times we don't want to shake hands with people. And Confucian culture broke down all the time because there'd be people who were out of harmony and weren't shaking hands because they didn't want to shake hands because others were out of harmony. Why would they shake hands with someone who was disharmonious? So that's why the harmony part, without the sense of oneness, doesn't work. And this teaching is about the undividedness between me and you. We're undivided. In my individuality, I'm completely undivided from you. Before I think about it, before I try to do anything, we're undivided. I just got back from Paris, where my grandkids live, and my daughter lives, and other people live. Most of whom I don't have much contact with because I don't speak a word of French, but I try to be. I know how to say I don't speak French in French. Although when I do say it, my grandson just roars with laughter. That's not right, Grandpa. Anyway. So about 21, 22 years ago, my daughter called me from Paris. She's been there a long time, right? She came home for a while, but she's back there now, right? And she said, telling me about what she was doing. She'd been to a health club in Paris, and she liked it. But she said, you know, they don't shake hands, Dad, here. I said, yeah, I know, Aaron. Didn't you get told about that? And she said, well, I went to this health club, and the guy greeted me, the health club guy. I'd never met him. I'd never been there before. And he expected me to kiss him on both cheeks, you know, and she said, and he had zits. She said, and he looked kind of yucky to me. She said, so what do I do? What do I do? Although she wasn't really asking. Well, she was asking, kind of, what do I do? So there's always someone we don't really want to shake hands with. That's why we need to settle into this undividedness, which is our true nature. We're undivided. But we're undivided in our individuality, just by being who we are, just by authentically being this rather than comparing. If we settle into that, then shaking hands with oneness is our natural activity. But I didn't say that to my daughter, you know. If you start preaching to your kids, they go away fast. Fast. So shaking hands is the activity of enlightened action. Shaking hands with oneness. Not focusing on having some enlightenment experience, some awakening. If you do that, you're not shaking hands. You're not extending yourself. Oh, she's got it and I don't. Oh, I've got it and she doesn't. How can you shake hands when you do that? Then you're just getting into a ruminating mode. It's very hard to shake hands and ruminate at the same time. It's impossible. Because when you shake hands, you just need to completely do it. Completely do it. So we express our oneness with all life by shaking hands. Or kissing on the cheeks, even if there are zits, right? Is it possible? Sure. Because we're not two, and yet we are two. We are two. We're individuals. We love our individuality. But we don't try to manipulate if we just settle into it. And within that individuality, we're not two. And we express our sense of oneness by generosity, by friendliness, by compassion. With humans, animals, plants, rocks, trees. You just do it. By shaking hands. by doing something, by doing an activity, not by having a special experience or trying to have a special experience, trying to have deep zazen. If you try to have deep zazen, you just waste your life. You won't shake hands with anyone. You'll just be trying to have deep zazen. Poor you. Poor boy. Poor girl. Because we want something instead of settling in to original oneness, stillness. So my daughter said to me 21 or 22 years ago, "What do you think I should do, Dad?" I thought, oh, she really is asking me for advice. She really is asking me, "What should I do, Dad?" I said, "Well, how many health clubs are there? This is it. Well, what are your choices?" You know, try to get her to think it through herself, right? She said, "Well, not go to the health club. Or go to it, but go around him so he doesn't, or you know, just refuse to kiss him on the cheek." I said, "Well, kiss him on the cheek." I said, "Just go ahead, kiss him on the cheek." And she never took my advice anyway, so, you know, kiss him on the cheek. Katagiri used to say people would always come to him, that's the teacher here, the founding teacher, and ask him for advice, and they never took it. He said, "I gave it this advice after advice after advice, and nobody ever took it." But he said, "I still give it." You know, you're shaking hands. If someone wants your support, they ask your support, you're shaking hands by giving them support. Because you're not different from them. You have the same struggle as they do. You do. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter what situation your life is in. It's the same struggle. We're all in the same struggle. So, I say sometimes in my talks, fake it until you make it. Fake your Zen practice. Fake your meditation. Fake your shaking hands with oneness until you make it. Fake it until you make it. Aspiration. We're aspiring to manifest the harmony of separation and oneness. Harmony of separation and oneness. So I gave an example about this a while ago with my first teacher, Suzuki Roshi. I got to know his son Oto Hiro in San Francisco, where I studied Zen as a young man. And his son, Oto Hiro, was a barber in San Francisco. That's his younger son. His older son was a Zen priest. He did the kosher way. But his younger son cut people's hair. And I said to Oto Hiro one day, "Oh, your father. Boy, you grew up with a Zen master, your father." And he said, "Boy, that must have been incredible growing up with him. He's so fluid, he's so open, he's so generous. He was always shaking hands with oneness wherever he was." For I thought it seemed to me that way he was, just naturally. And Oto Hiro said, "Oh, you don't know." He said, "You don't know. Not same man. Not same man when I was young. Not same man." I went back and I've been reading Crooked Cucumber, which is the book about my teacher's life. I'd never read the whole thing, but now some of my students are doing a book about my talks and my interaction with him, so I thought I'd better go back and read the book to see how off I was, or how off. Anyway, what am I saying? Well, I'm talking about Oto Hiro. Oh yeah. I don't know. I lost track of what I was saying. But anyway, Oto says, "Not same man. Not same man." And oh, I read in the book about when he had his kids, he used corporal punishment a lot. He was mean. He disregarded them. He's always off running after temples and doing zazen. And I could see he was not the man. He was not the man. So he faked it until he made it. He faked it until he made it. Of course, we never make it. That's the problem, is that you'll be expecting to make it. But you make it the moment you shake hands. The moment you just shake your hand. Zits or no zits, you just shake hands. Then you make it. But you don't think I made it. You just shake hands. Right? That's all there is to it. Too simple for you guys. It's too simple. Too simple. So, not the same man. 40 years later. I didn't know him until he was 65. You know, 65. And he'd been practicing since he was 15 doing this silly practice of sitting facing a wall day after day. Shaking hands with oneness. At least trying. Trying. Doing his best. Zits and all. Doing his best. Okay, so that's the title. The title. Harmony of Separation and Oneness. Harmony of the Many and the One. Now I'll talk about the first line. The mind of the great sage of India is intimately transmitted from west to east. West to east. So the mind of the great sage of India. And this refers to Buddha, the historical Buddha, the mind of the historical Buddha, the great sage of India. And the term that's used is Shin, the Shin. And those of you who've studied, you know that term. It's one of the most, it's Shin, heart mind, heart sutra, believing in heart mind by Sungsan. The mind of the great sage of India. And of course, they say the mind of the great sage of India, but if it's really big mind, it doesn't belong to the great sage of India, does it? It's not the great sage of India's mind, but it's really big mind. Not Suzuki Roshi's translation. He uses a kind of a crude translation. Big mind, big mind. And within the mind of the great sage of India, within that big mind, we don't get attached to a special experience of depression or loneliness or enlightenment or zits on our face or zits on your face. We don't. We don't. So Suzuki Roshi says about this, whatever kind of bird flies through the sky doesn't care. This guy doesn't care. Yeah. Yeah. And of course, there are lots of birds that fly through the sky, through our sky, all the time. Lots of different types of birds. Some are beautiful, some are not beautiful. Some are exciting, some are not exciting. So, my grandson, who's almost three, is developing a little self-monitoring bird. Little self-monitoring bird, almost 3 years old. Little Logan bird. The other day I was with him and we were kind of playing rough. I didn't want to play rough, but I ended up playing rough because he's got little boy energy. Then I find some little boy energy too. And so he opens his mouth and he starts to bite me, right? he gets his mouth, I mean, really fast, you know, it's fast. He gets his mouth down on my whatever this is, shoulder, and then he jumps off. He pulls himself away, and he looks at me. He said, "No me bite, Grandpa. No me bite. Logan no bite." Self is a little self-monitoring bird. He's just developing his little self-monitoring bird. His little individual bird. We need to take care of our individual birds. But his is so cute because it's just barely getting formed. Once they get formed, they're not so cute, are they? And once they get formed, they're just like, ugh. That's how we feel. Wah. I'd like to go back and reform my bird. So so his bird will develop. He'll have lots of birds, right? And at some point, his little Minobite grandpa bird will develop into some internal dialogue bird. I mean, right now, all of his dialogue is external. I mean, that's why he's so cute, right? There's no internal dialogue. It's like, oh, Minobite grandpa. He hasn't gotten the internal part yet. But when he gets that, he'll get the internal critic. Along with the internal dialogue comes the internal critic. It's part of self-monitoring. Part of how we harmonize culture. We don't self-monitor. We don't harmonize. And then the self-monitoring bird, the inner critic bird, wants to take over the whole sky. Chase all the other birds away. Deny there is any sky. Be the whole thing. Then everybody rushes to Zen Center. Oh, Zen. Oh, whew. Oh. Maybe some relief, right? But then you sit and face the wall, and what happens? Well, you get a little relief for a while. This long, or maybe this long, or maybe this long. And then, ooh. All that horse shit stuff comes up again. Right? All the pissing and moaning comes up again. Double, triple, quadruple, pissing and moaning. Right? So, the inner critic in the sky, the hawk in the sky, there's plenty of room for the hawk in the sky. Just let the hawk fly in the sky. Let it just be there. Don't need to... Hawk has its own beauty. The sharpness of its beak, the beatiness of its eyes. It has Zen eyes, you know. It's always looking for something to criticize, right? But unfortunately, it wastes its mindfulness energy with this critical energy. But that's needed socially too, to a degree. We need that socially to a degree. So, and if your bird, if my grandson's bird is Logan Bird, his name's Logan, grows up, develop, maybe it will have some wounds from having bitten Grandpa too many times, and Grandpa did something to retaliate. Not doubtful. It's doubtful that I would. Maybe I didn't do anything to retaliate. So it thinks of itself as omnipotent or something, which is just a fact. So and then even needs to, when it becomes a big grown-up bird, it needs to have bird therapy. Bird therapy to work on its bird self-esteem, so it won't feel damaged anymore. We'll be able to enjoy its life. Well, that's good. Therapy is good. Good. We should take advantage of it when we can use it, because we need to take care of the individual, ourselves, our unique situation, our unique problems, and not just say, oh, we're all one. Don't do that. You're all one when you take care of this, when you pay attention to this and to this, and really, really give it your kind attention, really shake hands with it, really kiss it on the cheek. Suzuki Roshi says, the mind of the great sage of India is innately self-respecting, has innate self-esteem, innate self-esteem. So when you don't fixate on the bird, the Tim bird, the Logan bird, the critical bird, the excited bird, the comparing bird, then there's a radical and complete form of self-respect, which is the great sage, this mind of the great sage of India, your own mind, your own big mind, which is not yours, not anybody's. So Suzuki Roshi says, when you do something without any feeling of having done something, that is you yourself. You're completely with everyone, and you don't feel self-conscious. That is self-respect. Yes. Shaking hands with oneness. That is self-respect. So a story that I've told a few times, but probably only once in the last 5 years, is Suzuki Roshi and I in the San Francisco area where I'm from, and he wants to go visit this woman. And this woman, somehow, why I am driving him to visit this woman, I don't remember, except that I'm available and I'm driving him from San Francisco to visit a woman in a wealthy suburb. I can remember the wealthy suburb. And okay, so I'm just taking him to visit this woman. I say, well, have you ever been there before? He said, no, I haven't. I've not been there before, but I need to go visit her. So we have very crude directions, and it's in a town called Hillsboro in California that has a lot of hills in it. It's quite beautiful. We're driving around. I'm driving. He doesn't drive. Right? I'm driving around, and her name is Mrs. Doherty, and finally we get up to the address, and it's kind of a state-like place, sort of a state-like, yeah. And so he said, you stay here, I'll go up. Thanks. All right. I mean, he's my teacher. You know, if he wants me to stay there, I'll stay there. So then he leaves. And, of course, what's he wearing? He's wearing what are called Japanese Zen traveling clothes, Japanese priest traveling clothes. Do you guys know what Japanese priest traveling clothes are? Well, I barely can remember them, but he has some black sort of pantaloons on. And then something like a, what's that thing that the Steve Hagen wears? What's it called, Rosemary? Pardon? A hapari. Huh? Oh, yeah, a hapari. A black hapari. And, you know, he's this little Japanese guy. And this is the San Francisco Bay Area in 1965, let's say. This is only 20 years after the end of World War II. The Japanese had all been interned. They'd all been sent to camps. So they'd lost their money, their stature. Then they'd come back. And I only knew, before I met Suzuki Roshi, I only knew Japanese who were gardeners and who were cleaning ladies. The cleaning lady in our house was Japanese. She was the only Japanese person that I'd ever met, except I saw the Japanese gardeners around. So we only knew Japanese in those contexts, except for the restaurants. There are three Japanese restaurants. So, okay, so I'm just setting the scene, right? So he goes up. He's gone quite a while, but the house is sort of high up on the hill. And then he comes back, and he gets in the car. And I say, how'd it go? He said, very interesting. And I said, he said, but not the Mrs. Doherty that I thought. Different Mrs. Doherty. I said, oh. He said, yes. She thought I was there to wash her windows. And he laughed and laughed and laughed. And I said, oh. He said, but I didn't bring my window washing equipment. And he laughed and laughed, and we got in the car and drove away. Did he feel demeaned? Did he need to go into therapy for self-esteem issues? was his self-respect damaged? I don't think so. I don't think so. He seemed to think he played a practical joke on her. So, shaking hands with oneness. Shaking hands with oneness, you guys. And we don't get caught by this stuff very much. We don't get caught by it very much. Then our thoughts don't have this hypnotic power over us. We use them when we're helpful, when they're helpful. Lots of times they're helpful. We need them. And then just let them go. So when I'm getting ready to give my talks, if I follow my teacher's advice, my teacher Katagiri said, when I was getting ready to give my first talk, he passed me on the stairway downstairs to the basement, and he said, think. Oh, that's great help. Think. But of course, that's right. When you're preparing for a talk, You're just shaking hands with the talk that you're giving. You're shaking hands. You're wholeheartedly preparing. You don't know anything else. Just think. Just think. And then if I'm enjoying myself with you guys, I'm just shaking hands with you during the talk. And then after, I can let go of it entirely. Let go of it. Let go of it. Maybe it'll come back later in some other birdie form, probably, or some other form. That's fine. They always come back. Everything comes back. So I was working with Wanda Isle from our Sangha a couple weeks ago, and she gave me some stuff to look at, some stuff to read. And I read it, and I said to her, "Oh, that's pretty good. I like that. I could use it in a talk." And she said, "Those are your words. That is your talk." Ooh, wow. Go back and read some of my old talks. So fake it until you make it is to do something wholeheartedly that you originally don't feel wholehearted about. I'm sorry. Originally, you don't feel wholehearted about it. This is our practice. Shaking hands with oneness. Shaking hands with oneness. So, Suzuki Roshi, when I first met him, I said, "Well, what's the most important thing in Zen?" "For me," I said, "for me. I'm serious. I really want to do this." And he said, "Well, the most important thing is just get up." Because I had just moved to across the street from Zen Center. "Just get up in the morning and come sit with us. That's the most important thing." I thought, "Oh, okay." And a couple days later, I went back up. I did that a few days, and I just got up. Although it wasn't just getting up. It was grumbling, getting up, and going back down, and getting up. But then I came back, and I said, "Well, what's the second most important thing?" He said, "Just get up." And I didn't go back a third time because I knew he was just going to be a smartass again. So. Just get up. And I didn't feel wholehearted about it. It was awful for me my first few years of sitting because I was on a reverse schedule. When did I go? I slept through my classes in college, and then I got up around noon or 1, and then I stayed up very late at night. So if I wanted to sit at Zen Center, I would stay up all night drinking coffee, and then I would sit. My Suzuki was on to me, which is why he just said, "Just get up." The problem with just getting up is that it means you have to first just go to bed. You have to second just for not do the coffee or the alcohol before bed. You have to third, all the things that are involved. Just getting up is not that easy. Not that you got to do really regulate your life to fit in meditation and really be serious about it. You have to really regulate your life. You have to really want it. Really want it. So finally, so I faked it for a while. getting up. Because that's what not just because that's what he said I should do, but because it made sense to me, kind of, not entirely, but kind of. So I faked it, and I made it. I got up for, 25 years. I got up. We were over in Northeast Minneapolis. Zen Center was at Southeast Minneapolis. We got up. I got up 6 days a week for years, but now we only get up 4 days a week. Really early in the morning here at Zen Center. So that's cool. That's cool. And now, as some of you know, now I have health problems. So I went to the doctor, and the doctor said, I said, "Well, what's the most important thing for me to get better?" What do you think the doctor said?
Sleep. Don't get up.
Don't get up at 5 a.m. Just stay in bed. Oh, shit. Excuse me. I thought I'd made it. I'm the Zen master around here, right? Just lie in bed. I'm really attached to the just get up bird. Oh, I've got the just get up bird down so well. I can fly in the sky. Everybody looks at me. He's just here every morning. Wow, look at him. He must be an eagle. Beyond Eagle Scouts, the eagle itself, the original eagle. The mind of the great sage of India in eagle form. Right. Well, now I have a new practice, which is just lying best. Oh, we get attached. We want our bird to behave. Our bird is finally performing. Finally got it down. We've got it made. What happens? What happens? But you know, the mind of the great sage of India doesn't even know the difference. Doesn't even know the difference. Luckily for us, that's where our real self-respect is. That's where our real self-respect is. In that mind, in this mind. So, one of the mantras that I say to myself, and I've said to myself over the years, when I'm having trouble shaking hands with oneness, when there are too many zits on my face or the whatever face I'm trying to shake hands with, is just this, just this. It's our simple teaching, just this, just this. So to help me come back, to help me come back. So 22 years ago, I called my daughter up a couple of weeks afterwards. I hadn't heard from her. I called her up and I said, "How's it going?" She said, "Pretty well." I said, "Well, what about that health club?" And she said, "Well, Dad, I took your advice." Oh, wow, she took my advice. She never took my advice when she was an adolescent, but now she's just leaving adolescence. She takes my advice once. "Dad, I took your advice." And I said, "How's it going?" And she said, "Oh, it's going fine." I said, "Yeah, but how's the kissing on the zitty cheeks going?" Oh, she said, "Oh, it's going fine. It's going fine. It only took a few tries, Dad. Not that big a deal. Now we're friends." But I still don't like those zits. But we're friends. We're friends. If we do it, then we manifest this big mind. We manifest this big mind. If we just do it until the friendship just is acknowledged. The friendship is always there, of the sky for the birds. I mean, the birds are the sky's enjoyment. They are the sky's fun. They are the sky's television. They're the sky's music. They're the sky's ballet. Even the hawks do their hawk ballet. Even the inner critic ballet. Inner critics are very precise sometimes. Their form is very pristine and very meticulous. Sky loves that meticulous precision of the inner critic. Why not? Why not? The mind of the great sage of India is intimately transmitted from west to east, from west to east. Of course, west starting in India, right? West starting in India. West going to China, going to Japan, going to the U.S. And this intimate transmission is a big deal in Zen. And there's a whole mythology about this transmission. And we recite, we have our lineage papers, our lineage charts, and people who become initiated are part of this transmitted lineage, which is part mythological, a whole bunch mythological. But it seems to be a vitally important myth in the Zen tradition. Mahakasapa, from Buddha in the flower sermon to Mahakasapa, Bodhidharma to Wei Kuo, his first disciple, Rujing to Dogen, the shaking hands of separateness and oneness. a way of being that gets passed on, gets passed on. And how does it get passed on? I don't exactly know how it gets passed on. It does get passed on. And maybe a lot of it is mythological. But something happens. And so when I talk about this, sometimes I say it seems to be like an imprinting that happens. An imprinting. Of course, we get imprinted in lots of ways, from lots of different experiences, from the time that we're young. So maybe it's a form of imprinting. I don't know. Second way of translating the harmony of difference and oneness is the harmony of light and darkness. So light being separation and darkness being oneness. And when I think about my own imprinting, I have certainly Suzuki Roshi imprinted on me big time. Big time. Big time. But then I think about my family members, different family members imprinted on me, some in not so healthy a way, right? Some in healthy way, not so healthy way. That's why we have to be on therapy for all those years to deal with the unhealthy imprinting. But some, we have some healthy imprinting too, or we wouldn't be here. As a first child, I spent a lot of time with my grandparents, and I had a couple of grandmothers, one of whom I almost never talked about, and they imprinted on me. And my grandmother, who was kind of quiet and kind of introverted, really imprinted on me. About being safe in darkness. Interesting. I mean, in a kind of fundamental 4-year-old way, safe in darkness. Because when I was a little kid, I was not, and most little kids aren't. My grandsons want the night lights on. My 6-year-old wants 3 night lights on. Night light here, night light there. Darkness is a scary thing for kids and for adults, right? It's scary. So the harmony of light and darkness. Well, that's interesting. So when I thought about this, I thought about my grandmother. And I used to go stay with her in her house by the ocean. And it was very dark. It was very foggy. This is San Francisco. Fog. Just whoosh. And this is not in the middle of the city. So dark. So dark. And I was kind of freaked out by darkness. I didn't want to go to be there at first. But my grandmother was so kind, and she let me sleep in bed with her, something my parents never did. And her bed was very comfortable and very soft. And she let me cuddle right next to her. Well, you know, this is something 4-year-olds love this. Well, 68-year-olds love this too. Yeah. So she let me cuddle. And so I began to relax in darkness. I can remember going back to Berkeley, to my parents' house, and not needing the nightlight after being with my grandmother for 2 weeks, because I was feeling safe in darkness, feeling comfortable, feeling relaxed. Interesting. And I in Berkeley, where I live, this was kind of high up on a hill, and there were lots of holes, rabbit holes. I was always scared of those holes. I can remember, Mommy, I don't want to go around those holes. I want to go by those holes, right? I don't want to see those holes. Little caves, little formations, shadows even. Typical. But spending time with my grandmother and just being in darkness and her being so relaxed. And in the daytime, my grandmother and I just didn't do much of anything. We had kind of a meditative environment. My siblings were not there, luckily, and I just had my grandmother to myself. So we would do things like make tapioca. I make good tapioca at 4. And work in a rose garden and do many things. And the more that I relax in the darkness, the more I just enjoy being with her. Which is exactly what Suzuki Roshi says in this book. He says, if you learn to be intimate with darkness, you will really appreciate the light. You will really appreciate individuality and separateness and the world as it is. But you have to go into darkness first. You have to shake hands with darkness first so that you can enjoy the light. Until you have completely shaken hands with darkness, you'll always be a shadow that you'll be scared of in the light, and it will inhibit your ability just to shake hands, just to kiss on the cheeks, zit or no zits. So the more comfortable we become with the darkness, the more comfortable and appreciative we are in the light. So that's what I want to talk about today. This is our transmission that we do in Zen. We do this, but we don't know about transmission. We don't know anything about that. We just do what we do. Something gets passed on. And it doesn't even have to be Buddhist. If you think it's Buddhism we're trying to pass on, you're missing it. You're missing it. You're trying to pass something on without going into complete darkness so that you can enjoy the light. Forget about Buddhism. This is the intimacy of life enjoying all of its manifestations. You're passing that on by imbibing in it yourselves, by soaking in it yourselves. So that maybe Buddhism will survive in this country, but it doesn't matter. Maybe human species will survive. Human species is not doing too good. I mean, the human species is doing not good because of what? Well, there are lots of reasons, but really, climate change is the biggest reason. And the human species, what are the human species thinking in relation to climate change? What are Americans thinking? I don't get it. But if the species survives, we can show the species how to do this, all of us together. And then as the species ends itself, we all go back to darkness and we come up in another way. We do everything coming and going, everything light and dark simultaneously. But it would be nice if we could help the species a little bit. Just enjoy all the birds in the sky without being so blind to the hurt that we're causing ourselves and others. Okay, that's what I want to talk about. Questions, comments? Yeah.
So when I was a kid, which was actually a couple of years before you were a kid.
Really? You're older than me?
My parents loved their children, including me. So they were very concerned about our ethical development, as well as providing all kinds of other support. But I remember them reading a book to us called The Watchbirds. And The Watchbirds, it was a kind of a series of these little three-panel cartoons. And in the first panel, there'd be some kind of problem situation, and Johnny or Bobby or Joni or somebody, Grace, would be confronted with this problem. And then in the second panel, they'd be reacting in some kind of negative way, you know, throwing a tantrum, whatever, being cruel to an animal. And in each of these panels, there were these little birds. They were watchbirds. And they were watching Johnny or Billy or Grace do these terrible things. And down in the corner, there was another little watchbird watching you. And it was even labeled, "This is the watchbird watching you."
Uh-oh.
So, wow. I don't know where my parents got the idea to read us this book. I would love to be able to ask them and find that out. Did
they
ever read it? Did your parents ever read anything like that to you?
No, that sounds cool. Sounds cool. And of course, we can go two ways with that, can't we? I mean, the watchbird can be just a beacon which is shaking hands with us, which is helping us pay attention, or it can be the critic, looking as if we're the super ego. So hopefully it's not the superego. We get the superego mixed up with just mindfulness, with just bare attention. Bare attention doesn't have anything to do with should. Nothing to do. Doesn't mean we don't need should. We need self-control. But that's not bare attention. That's not shaking hands. Oneness. Thanks. Great story. Bring it. Oh, you wouldn't be able to find the book, would you? If you Googled it, you might be able to.
I'll check it out.
Anybody else?
I wonder if you could talk a little more about, the thing about the zip was so important to me. Because it's easy to shake hands when you're on the same page or
has
zip. And so I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about the zip thing. And what if it's bigger than zits? What if they're coming at you with a sword?
What if it's bigger than zits? For instance, what were you saying?
What if they're coming at you with a sword?
Oh, yeah. Well, let's just remember that all these things I say are just birds in the sky. It's a first thing to remember. They're birds in the sky. So if someone's coming at you with a sword, I better not... You better protect yourself, right? But in that case, you know you're in bodily danger. I mean, here my daughter is in a health club. This is the proprietor of the health club. She may think he's yucky, but he does this with everyone. He's the proprietor. He lives there. He owns it. She's turned off by it. She doesn't feel safe, but it's of no threat to her consciousness, nor to her body. She feels it's a threat, and she has to use her bare attention mind, her wholehearted shaking hands to get through that threat. And she does it. She's not even a Zen student. She does it. I'm proud of her. I'm proud of her. Because you don't need to be a Zen student to do this. What's that? I think we always need to assess the situation. Are we in psychic danger or physical danger? And then, of course, we don't shake hands. Of course we run like hell. But that's the bird in the sky. I mean, we're manifesting the mind of the great sage of India when we run like hell, so that we can survive to enjoy this big mind, share it with others. So, but I think it's always a judgment call. And sometimes we make a mistake. Okay, we make a mistake. We're a little more paranoid than we need to be. We need a little paranoia in our lives. Paranoia is healthy. People say Zen, no, a little paranoia is good. But we get so carried away. We get so carried away. You know, there's a speaking of paranoia, there's been research on clinical depression and paranoia, and research showing that people with clinical depression often have a more realistic assessment of the world than people without. It's true. I'll show you the data. Google it. I'm just throwing that in. Just another bird in the sky, right? That's another bird in the sky. Anybody else? Okay, thank you.